Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Reel 19. So we haven't, I'm afraid, got quite as much time to go through the rest of your career, but we're still interested to know what you did.
Well, very quickly, Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Algernon Willis, who was the chairman of the board, or what he'd like to call it, the expedition, I suppose he thought he was doing me a favour and thought I'd been away, and I was drafted to Whitehall WT in London.
Now, what was that?
It was the main radio station of the Royal Navy, but because I was a qualified instructor and they hadn't had one before, instead of being put on communications, the officer in charge wanted me to act like a correspondence course tutor for the sailors there. Well, as everybody knows, sailors in London don't want to do any correspondence courses. All they want to do is to go down the West End and meet with the Dolly Birds. So it was perhaps the most boring time. What I did do, though, while I was there, I decided I would prove that I could qualify for a commission. So as I was shore-based there, and I had access to the hydrographic office in Admiralty, which had all the charts, I decided to take my higher educational test, which is the educational qualification for going through for a commission. Compulsory subject, being a communicator, was English. Otherwise, you choose your own subjects. I chose English, navigation, general knowledge, and geography. You can take the subjects one at a time, but knowing I wasn't going to be there long, I decided to do all four. I did all four and passed them. Later on, I got my 3 6-monthly recommends for a commission, passed my medical for a commission, by which time I was too old to have a commission in my branch. But I proved to myself that I could do it.
So that was almost more important to you than getting the commission, was proving that you could have done it. If you'd been got earlier.
Well, having lived closely with officers, I realised I was as good as them, putting it bluntly. For the Imperial War Museum.
That's not particularly demeaning officers as much as saying you were as good. You're not saying they're bad, you're saying you were as good as they were.
I'll come to something that refers to that later on, I won't take time. Other than that, quite boring.
That was from 55 to 56.
I got drafted. I went back to Mercury, then on to Nicosia WT station.
Now, is that Aphrodite?
Yeah, Aphrodite, Nicosia WT station. This is during the Ioka terrorist troubles. Whilst in...
That was 1956, March 56, yeah. Quite a while from the looks of it. A
few months, actually, that's all.
And tell us about that.
We had a radio station in the central compound in Nicosia, alongside which was an army station. Obviously, Ioka Terrace, so one had to be careful. All the lads had rifles, POs and chiefs had pistols. Normally, you went around in vehicles and that sort of thing. Although I did, being an inquisitive sort, I wanted to see the old city of Nicosia. I had a 4.5 revolver, which was rather bulky. I stuck it in my pocket and covered it with a handkerchief and wandered into the old city of Nicosia, which was out of bounds, and had a wander around, had a look around. Went into a club there and had a drink, pulled my handkerchief out of my pocket and dropped my gun on the floor, which was rather dangerous. And Cypriot picked it up and handed it back to me. And the lady who ran the bar had a laugh, and she said they couldn't get Scotch whisky. So I said, oh, I can get some Scotch whisky for you. Or should I be most grateful? So I said, I'll come back tomorrow. So that time we were living, all the lads were living in tents and tent lines, and we were living with an army unit and two detached bungalows in the outskirts of Nicosia. Had their own little bar there, and most of the soldiers had their wives out there, so they were actually living at Dikelia. Used to come in by bus every day, and just a few of us living in these And I saw the corporal in charge of the bar and bought a bottle of scotch, which was duty-free. Next night I took it to this place and gave it to her. And she said, how much? And I told her. She said, oh, I said, well, that's what I pay for. I said, I have to make a profit. See? So that was a little aside. Anyway, while I was there, I...
Hang on. Was there much of a threat from Eoka, really? I mean, how serious was the threat to you, to you, servicemen?
There were people being shot in the back of the head. I mean, we had some from our unit, the army blokes. They were coming in on the bus from Dhekelia in the morning to come to work. And the terrorists got older. They had some of these London double-decker buses. Just drove the bus straight at them. The driver jumped out, hit the coach. A warrant officer in the front, he was killed instantly. Mate of mine, a sergeant, who was always drunk, quite a character, he was stretched out on the back seat. He just lost his right ear. It was just torn off. And they sewed it back on again. But, there was a threat out there. And the thing was that, found out afterwards, a lot of the people got shot in the back, was that it wasn't actually the terrorists that were doing the shooting. The terrorists used to put a gun with one bullet in through someone's letterbox with a note saying, you will shoot a soldier, otherwise your family will be wiped out. So you had an ordinary chap, terrified out of his wits, obviously couldn't face someone and shoot him in the back. It was just one of those things. So there was a threat out there.
And what was your job? You weren't instructing, you were just on the stage.
Radio communications, yeah, just... You know.
Had things moved on at all in the way, you know?
We were in a Nissan hut. Right, so I was in the Nissan hut. And one of my leading telegraphers there, later when he was a chief, was the chief of the Royal Yacht for Majesty's Queen, Chief Spark on the Royal Yacht for many, many years. And I understand, Dixie Dean was very, very popular with the Queen. She thought the world of him. I still meet him regularly, Dixie.
That's a different Dixie Dean from the...
The Dixie Dean. The Dixie Dean on the expedition died not long after the expedition came back. He had a heart attack, unfortunately.
Now, so you were just on the... Was it the same old wirelesses, the same routines?
Yes, same routine, communicating back and forth, basically.
Now, anything happened to you while you were there?
Yeah, my promotion to chief came through.
Now, how important was that to you? I mean, wanted promotion. It's difficult to get to CPO, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, you see, when you qualify for a PO tower, you qualify automatically for chief. It's the same. It's just a case of the recommends and the time. And the promotion varied in the different depots. Devonport people were getting made chief. We're talking about communicators getting made chief in 3 and 4 years. It was about 15 years in Portsmouth, and it was even longer in Chatham. Well, evidently, they, unbeknown to me, they decided to combine the rosters, so all chiefs were the same, which meant that Devonport would go for donkey's years waiting to get made a chief, and Pompey and Chatham move up. And because it was a funny thing that what used to happen, when I used to go on watch, the truck used to pick up the lads in the tent lines, come to our bungalow, pick me up, and then go to the headquarters in Nicosia, where the radio station was. And there was a leading writer amongst the lads going to work. And he said, your B-13's come through. B-13 is the paper which is the form for your promotion. And I'd been a PO then 11 and a half years. And I said, don't give me that. And I didn't believe him, you see. So he said, it's true, true. I said, no, don't give me that, you see, knowing that the period we were waiting was about 15, 16 years. So I said, well, what was the date of my official promotion? He said, April the 1st. So I said, get away with it. In actual fact, it was quite true. My promotion was April the 1st, 1956. Well, it came through. And so what happened, one medal I always wanted was the Naval General Service Medal, which, that were given for different services, and then you put a bar on where you served, like if you served in Naval General Service Minesweep, Naval General Service. Because my chief's rate came through, Commander-in-Chief of Mediterranean, said I had to be shifted because they wanted me in Malta. So I left Cyprus just under the time to qualify to get my Naval General Service Medal.
And that would be about June, from the looks of things, when you go to St. Angelo?
Yeah,
And is that Malta?
Yeah, there's various bases in Malta, and I was moved from St Angelo to Lascaris to Phoenicia. They're different bases there, just as the Navy were moving. I was still doing the same job. But the thing was, the one thing that did please me about Cyprus, I got my long service and good conduct medal. I was in Cyprus. So on the edge of the long service and good conduct medal, you know, your name is engraved with the ship you served on the time. So I've got long service and good conduct to Aphrodite, the goddess of love. So that tickled me pink, that did. I went...
Were you sorry to leave Cyprus then?
Yeah, well, because yeah, I mean, I had a good crowd of lads. And I used to look after them. I used to go out to the tent lines regularly because, you know, they were living rough. There was hundreds and hundreds of tents. We called them tent lines, masses of tents with army, navy in, you see. And I was proud of the lads. They made the most of their tents. I mean, the army chaps had their tents as supplied. 140-watt bulb in and a tent. You went along to the naval boats' tents. They had a chandelier inside, didn't they? Because the one building on the tent lines was a building they put up with a galley in and the dining room where they all went to eat, you see. So the sailors had collected wood from packing cases and they made a cross. So they had five bulbs, you know, one in the centre and one on the arm of each cross at the end, with a little pulley up in the top of the tent and a rope so they could hoist it up and down. They got packing cases and they built a porchway to their tent, which was about 6 foot long, and nailed the tent to it. And they even they had latrines where the galley and the dining room was. And the sailors, not being fools, previously pinched a pot of paint and a brush from somewhere. Then in the middle of the night, they went and whipped one of the doors off one of the latrines and its hinges and screwed it to their porchway and painted it. And the army never twigged because it was a different colour. It was the same door. And inside they had nails with their coats hanging up. And they built themselves little bedside tables, you might say, in their tents. They really looked hard. But I used to go out regularly to see them. We used to run trips.
And these were your wireless. Who were these?
These are the chaps in my watch. You know,
yeah, so they were your signallers.
The signallers in my watch. Because we used to run trips to the beach from where we used to, you know, when they were off watch, we used to lay on a truck and go to a beach. And one bloke, they'd put all their rifles and, you can hook the rifles up and stand them up. One bloke stand guard while the others went swimming and so on. So they had their fun. And because the booze was cheap out there, that's the trouble. I mean, you had to be careful blokes didn't get brandyitis and that sort of thing. But they were a good bunch of lads, really good. And I did arrange for all the chaps on the watch and the radio. I got in touch with Coca-Cola and said, could we have an ice box? Because it's very hot out here. Nicosia is stiflingly hot. I've never known it hot so hot anywhere. And I got this small icebox, and I said, my lads like cocoa, put a bit of flannel in, my lads like cocoa, there's a bit of that. They've got anything, they got orange juice, that sort of thing. And I arranged for a daily delivery of ice from a local ice merchant, so we always had this icebox in the radio centre, and the chaps used to stick their bottles of pop and what have you in there, could have nice cold drinks.
Now, so you were only there about 3 months, really?
Well, it was less than 3 months, because I think 3 months was the qualifying time for the long service good conduct.
Just now. Under three. And now, anything about your time in these... Well, it's St Angelo and Phoenicia.
I left there. I went to Paphos and went on a naval frigate to Malta. And I felt quite strange because I was a brand new chief and I was billeted in the chief's mess. And these chaps... it was a Devonport ship. And these chaps treated me like royalty, like a passenger on there. They were really good to me on there. We had a few runs ashore together in Malta afterwards. Then in Malta, I was watchkeeping. And this is one of the funny things, was that because I'd been a petty officer long, deep down inside, I wasn't worried about being a chief. The only thing about being a chief was I thought, you don't do any more watches, you see. And...
You mean actually on the wireless?
You know, 4 hours off, 8 hours, you know, 4 hours on, 8 hours off, or 4 hours on, four, you know, no more watchkeeping, you know, day work, you know, the chief does day work, like, sort of thing. And so I got made a chief in Cyprus, and I was watchkeeping there, because I still had to do the same job as I was as a PO, till I got relieved. And then I went to Malta, and I'm chief of a watch there, so I'm still watchkeeping. That's where I met Joan. Met Joan, because he was in the previous watch to me, and I met her.
So you met your wife. Tell us about that. Well,
she was a petty officer, ran signals. She wasn't radio, she was signals. And she was in the cryptographic office. And she was in the watch that I relieved. And the watches there are different. I mean, you used to do a 12-hour night watch. And communications there was quite horrendous, because the Suez crisis came up then, you see.
What effect did that have on them?
Malta was, not only was it a Royal Naval shore wireless station, it was a NATO station, one of the main NATO stations. And my estimation, the Wrens went up 100% there. Those girls, I mean, when you're on a 12-hour watch, you were on a 12-hour watch, there was none of this half-hour in the restroom and all this and that. You were on the go all the time. And those girls used to come off a watch, their ankles was twice the size sometimes. They'd been on their feet for 12 hours. But it was a 12-hour, it was a 12-hour night watch.
Talking about the Suez crisis, though.
The Suez crisis had come up, so that's when it was really hectic there, really hectic. And communications was hectic. But, as I say, the work there went on well, I enjoyed it.
And did you like Malta? As a
base?
Yeah.
One of the things I didn't mention when I came back from... I did mention when I went to Greenham was the party in Admiralty House. I think I mentioned it when all the ambassadors were there and admirals and goodness knows what. Well, when I was in Malta, the chief of Joan's watch, he was married to a Maltese woman, sometime before, and he had four children. And on Christmas Day, they had the afternoon watch where it went from... 12.
Doesn't matter.
It was a long watch, about 8 hours in the day. And so I said to Joe, I said, you know, there's nothing to Malta, and being a very, very religious place, there was nothing to do in Malta on Christmas Day. Everything was closed, shut, dead. So I said to Joe, I said, nothing for me to do. I said, I might just be on watch with the lads, you know. I said, you've got your family here, you've got your kiddies here. I said, I'll do your watch for you. You know, you go home, you see. Well, some of the chiefs on the staff there were put down on paper as being NATO, coming under NATO because it was a NATO base. They were entitled to duty-free spirit ration. So Joe repaid me by giving me some duty-free spirit, you see. And the Admiral, the CNC men, and all these all various officers, and, you know, Captain Lafitte, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, obviously was going round to people having to work on Christmas Day, you know, sort of paying a visit. So I'm stood there at the end of the radio receiving, because you had teleprinter rooms, radio teleprinter rooms, all, you know, cipher rooms, all that sort of thing, very big, because it was all in the caves underground. The commander-in-chief came through, and he must have recognised my polar medal. And he said, oh, hello, chief, nice to see you. And I reported, you see, I said, you know, sort of reported. He says, nice to see you. He said, that was an excellent party, wasn't it? So when he said excellent party, well, there's only one place I've been boozing up with an admiral, and that was in Admiralty, you see. And I said, oh, yes, sir, you see. And of course, there's all these officers ranging down in rank till they got to the base communication officer at the back, the lieutenant commander, you see. Having seen the commander-in-chief chatting to me, as he came up to me, he said, you never told me you knew the commander-in-chief. Well, I didn't like to tell him I didn't know, and I knew the commander. I just said to him, oh, I don't tell you everything, sir. the Suez do ended, and of course they brought a lot of people out from home for that, perhaps, you know, in rotation would have been longer at home. And they were going to send down a landing LCT, landing craft tank, to Suez, because of all the ships sunk in the Suez Canal. The idea was they were going to rig out on the tank deck rooms and places, and they were going to take a diving team down to go into the Suez to raise all the ships to get the Suez open again. And I suddenly saw this signal, and they were going to send back home asking for a chief to come out to go on the Lofoten, because the name was HMS Lofoten. Now, because of the Suez crisis, well, they had a signal school in Malta, and they closed the signal school down because there was no instructors, everybody was busy. And all the chiefs who were instructors were sitting around doing nothing. But because of the peculiar drafting situation, the people in Malta couldn't say to that a chief who was an instructor, he'd come under the authority back home, you see, you come over in the office. So there was some way around that couldn't do. And I was livid about this, so I went and saw the signal officer, and I said, "You're sending home for a chief," I said, "to come out to go on the phone down there." And I said, "There's all those chiefs sitting on their backside over there in the signal school." He said, "I can't touch them. See?" He said, "I can't send them onto the ship." I said, "Can you send them over here to the station?" He said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "Right, I'll volunteer to go on the phone, then you can pick one of those off their backside and put them over here and make him work for a living." So I went on the Lofoten. Now, the commander at the time had said to me, "We fully expect when you get down to Suez, the Egyptian army will come on board and take over the ship. There is to be no resistance." Yeah, they wanted to handle it diplomatically and get they wanted the Suez opened again, you see. He says, "Can you give me a plan for getting in communication so I know what's going on?" So it goes back to my famous old green lamp, Army Type 62. I thought, ideal set, little set. I said, "Yes, if I have a Type 62, I said, I can have secret aerial. I said, because of the rains, would need a ship just out of sight of the shore, like a destroyer or something, a frigate, something like that. And then if and when the Egyptian army take over the ship, close the wireless office, I can have this secreted away somewhere. I shall find out where and be able to communicate." So this was the plan. All fell by the board, because when we got down to Suez, the Egyptian army wouldn't let us in anyway. So we had to turn around and go back again. And what upset me a bit was when I went back, we hit a gale off the south of Crete, and there was no gale like it. It stove in the bow doors. The shipwright was down there up to his neck, virtually in water, shoring up with some of his helpers. I had these whip aerials on the side of this LCT, with very thick aerials at the base, and they were folded in half. It was a terrific gale. I mean, people don't realise the strength of the gales in the Mediterranean time. And although the ship was going full ahead on the engines, we were going backwards. But anyway, we cleared that. We got back to Malta, and I went back to the job. But what upset me a bit was the one man that had relieved me during these long watches was a chief radio supervisor called Harry Jones, who was the most unfit one of the chaps. He wasn't a very well man at all, was Harry. Never did look well. I'd known him for years.
So what was your next posting?
Well, I met Joan then, and we got close together. And she got a message because she'd lost her mum when she was a young girl, and she had a younger brother and sister. And her dad had he was a chief stoker in the Navy, and he'd finished his pensionable time when the war broke out, so he had to stay in for the war. And when he came out just after the war, his wife had died of cancer. So he brought up the three kids. And then Joan got a message to say her dad was dying in hospital. So they sent her home on compassionately. So I thought, my romance is ended, you see, because she was gone home. But it so turned out that once the Suez do ended, they had so many excess people out there. What they were doing was, because some of them were out there with their wives and it was expensive, taking the wives out there, the cost for the wives, passage and kids, sending home the single blokes. You see, so I hadn't completed the commission out, and I got sent home. So I come home and I followed Joan home, you know, a couple of months afterwards.
Now, what was your posting then? You seem to be at Trafalgar.
When I came back, I went to the signal school, new entry chief, in charge of the new entry division.
As an instructor?
No, I was in charge of the division, not regulating. So I had a lieutenant commander who was a new entry division officer. I had a lieutenant and a sub-lieutenant who were course officers for the courses. And I was the big chief, running everything sort of thing, you know, as chiefs do. I had 380 new entries. I had 6 chief petty officers and instructors. I had 25 petty officer instructors. I had 8 leading hands, you know, for different tasks. I had a mixture of long service, new entries, and national service. The national service were chaps that had been delayed national service because of education, things like that. And in actual fact, I have to say the national service blokes were superior to most of my long service. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
In what way?
The Navy at the time were dredging the barrel. I'm not saying, and there was a lot of good long service blokes, but I had a lot of rubbish amongst the long service blokes. They were dredging the barrel. And the national service blokes, they were keen, they were enthusiastic. They were good lads, and I had some good times there. I was known. They used to say I was an elephant. I never forgot. What they didn't realise, I kept a very good pad. I virtually knew everyone by name. I knew their background. I had John Howard Davis, a young boy actor who was in Great Expectations, as one of my new entries, who later became a producer. And I was responsible for them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, virtually. I had to make sure they were all dentally fit before they went to sea, so I used to liaise with the dental wren who used to come up in the office so that their courses lined up and they wouldn't be missing too much instruction. But at the same time, you know, we'd go through the records and get all dental appointments, medical appointments, so that when they left Mercury, apart from passing out, they were all dentally fit.
That was seen as important, was it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it must be. Yeah, so absolutely getting them all up to scratch. Because it amazed me that the standard of dental hygiene and youngsters coming in, or not just coming in the Navy, youngsters at that time were terrible compared to what we had to be. When I went in the Navy, you had to be virtually 100% perfect in your teeth. So we got that right. Little interesting points there. One day a young lad said to me, I'm an amateur radio man. He said, do you think I could get permission? He's one of my new entries, to bring my amateur radio in and operate it. And I said, I can't see any reason why not. I said, put a proper request in, put it before the division officer. Anyway, he got his request. He turns up and he built it himself. And this is the days of valves. It's a nice little thing. It's all in an attache case. And he had his little transmitter receiver in there and his Morse key and his headphones, cord of wire. And we fixed it, allowed him to run an air it out. He was in the upper block. Allowed him to run the air it out. And one evening I went round there and I, this time Joan and I got married. I got married when I was up there. And I went up and I said, if you ever want your frequency of your transmitter checking, I said, I've got a BC221 frequency meter. And he made me laugh. He said, no need, Chief. He said, my dad works at Baldock. Well, Baldock is the world international frequency checking station, which countries all over the world use. And he used to ring up his dad at this massive great station. He used to check his frequency for him. All right?